Have you ever stopped to wonder why it's so easy to create our ideal RPG characters, but so difficult to create our ideal selves? If you want to become just as confident and empowered in real life as your D&D character is at the table, join me for my brand new Identi-D&D Life Coaching Workshop. I use the character building framework from D&D for a casual but really effective way to identify what's holding you back from being the best version of yourself. Listen in at the end of the episode to learn more.
Welcome to The Compendium, a resource designed to help you spend less time learning D&D and more time actually playing.
All right, welcome back to episode 3 of season 2 of The Compendium. This episode, we are diving into another very classic fantasy race, and we are going to be talking about elves. I think it made a lot of sense because we actually alluded to them unintentionally in the last episode where we were talking about dwarves and some of the variation. So it's a really good picking up point to start from. And also, again, like I said, it's another one of the really classic characters within any fantasy. And so it's one I think more people are a little bit familiar with.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and if you're not into fantasy, then, you know, you're more into, like, you know, Star Trek, they're Vulcans. They're just fantasy Vulcans, or Vulcans or sci-fi elves, whichever one, that's fine.
So, yeah. And yeah. The thing is too with elves, I think, is that there's more than one type of elf. Well, yes. There's one type of elf, but in our minds, there's actually many types of elves. And we've had this conversation and we're like, these aren't necessarily Keebler elves.
No.
Right. And they're not Santa's elves.
No, those are not.
And so there is actually, let's maybe break down a little bit of like all of the stereotypes of elves and hone in on the common elves that you can picture when you think of D&D elves.
I think it goes back to like European and British Isles folklore of like the fairy people. And I think just anything from the fairy people were like elves. So like in a very broad sense, I think traditionally even like leprechauns are elves and fairies are elves. And so that's why you have such a broad swath of, you know, Santa's workshop of these little elves, like you see in the movie Elf, they're like wee. And then you've got the Keebler elves, which are, you know, just very comfortable to hang out with. And they're also small. So I think that's partly why they're like that. I don't want to say it was Lord of the Rings, but like, even if it wasn't the first, it was the thing that really codified elves as they are in so much fantasy that followed that series, and where they're now seen more as they're mortal plus, like either they're incredibly long lived or they are immortal in the sense that they don't have a natural end to their lifespan or they can choose it. They're, you know, about the same size as humans, maybe a little more slight. No beards or facial hair really to speak of, great archers. They're kind of magical in nature and all of that, and kind of like live in the woods or maybe on an island somewhere, you know, it's kind of like the general kind of vibe that they give off. But yeah, there's a lot of variations for sure.
Right. But like you said there, I mean, the ones what we're talking about are pretty much aligned with Tolkien elves in, right, that they're going to be about standard height of humans, maybe slightly shorter. They're going to be very slender. So I think the book says like somewhere around 100 plus pounds, just because they're graceful, they're lean. They're not necessarily going to be like sturdy and built like dwarves are, but they're not going to be the tiny little like gnome people or
halflings,
you know,
or yeah,
Santa's elves, yeah, that are running, yeah, around.
And as long as we're talking about Keebler elves, like those are clearly halflings. They stay at home and bake cookies all day, obviously halflings. And Santa's,
yeah, and they've got some lucky, uh-huh, in their blood because they're using fire in trees and somehow not lighting themselves up. So
yeah, and
totally,
Santa's totally got gnomes because totally they're tinkers. They're making like, you know, model trains and stuff, mm-hmm, and Tickle Me Elmos. I don't know. Anyway, So in D&D, elves are one of the playable races. They have been since the very beginning, back when elf was a both race and class in the first edition. Yeah.
Oh, really?
You're an elf. Like, what's your character? He's an elf. Cool. Like, that was the whole character. And then it was like magic user, which was like, okay, what kind of magic user? And you could pick like all kind of cleric-y things or all wizardy things, you know. So it's come a long way, but the things that have been, you know, kind of consistent throughout was kind of the physical description that you said, you know, middle 5 feet range, 100, 140 pounds, slight, and all those things, and very magical. I think every setting has a different origin for the elves, but typically they're seen as related to some kind of proto race from the Feywild, which is one of the planes that are kind of close to the prime material plane where all the fey creatures come from. So, like, you know, satyrs and fairies proper and pixies and brownies and all of that are coming from this kind of like other kind of like wild magic domain, but they're like a mortal version of that that lives and is born here on the prime material plane. And they live a really long time, about 700 years, about 10 times human lifespans or so. And they're kind of innately magical because of the long lives they have. Certain like proficiencies that are really good at, they're known as being very artful craftsmen, artists really more than craftsmen. And typically, you know, they either know how to use a little bit of magic no matter what they are, or they're always going to be pretty good with a bow and a sword no matter what else they are. So it's kind of just due to their magical long-lived natures.
Right. Let's rewind just a tiny bit, and it's not the right place to get into it in this episode, but you like totally info dumped there with alternate planes and all of this other stuff. And like, no, it's good. Like, I'm glad that information is thrown out there, but I don't think we've mentioned like 90% of the things that you just like rattled off. Like you were talking about, you know, your average Tuesday. So real quick, can you just give a simple concept of what the planes are? And I know you said these are creatures that are kind of from that plane, but born here. Can you just parse that out a tiny bit for people that are interested in playing elves, but aren't used to this concept of like the multi-tiered plane?
Right.
Universal. So
there's this great chart in the back of, I believe it's the Dungeon Master Guide, but in brief, it is, you know, like you have in like Marvel Comics, there's the multiverse or the multi-dimension kind of theory. But what this is that these are very kind of fixed and well-known and defined realms that are not other planets. They're just other planes of existence. And so you have the prime material, which is like where all the stuff happens. Then you have the ethereal plane, which is like the crawl space between the planes, right? It's like there's nothing there. It's just the thing you go through to get to another thing, like the hallways, basically. And they'll pop up in spells like Blink and Etherealness, Oil of Etherealness. Okay. And I even think Phase Spiders, that monster, they kind of go between it. And then they're not super inhabited. And then there's things like the Feywild and the... what is it called now? It's not the Underdark. It's not the plateau, the plane of shadow. It's called something else now. I forget what it is, but they're kind of in diametrically opposed. But the Feywild, to focus in on that, is basically like magic on steroids and nature on steroids. So it's like magical nature in abundance. And so this is where all creatures with the fey type kind of come from. And it's kind of a very magical, timeless place with massive forests. And there's going to be, and it's not evil, it's more chaotic than anything else. Mm-hmm. With chaotic magic, chaotic nature. And so it's not a bad place, it's just not a safe place. And so It's not recommended that you book an extended stay there. they only have like 2.5 stars on TripAdvisor, but got turned into a newt. Sorry, read the asterisks on the bottom.
Zero
of
the stars.
Yeah, I give it less stars, but I'm a newt. So yeah, and there's like gods and goddesses that live there as well. It's a place that you could plane shift to. And there's even places naturally occurring in the world where you could kind of find those weak places and get to there. And so the elves, I think the accepted kind of concept is that something from the Feywild came to the Primaterial and stayed, and that's what all the elves are descended from, is kind of the idea going on there.
Okay, that's helpful. Thank you for clarifying that concept the just Shadowfell. A little bit.
It's called the Shadowfell. That's Shadowfell. What it's called. The other thing.
The Feywild and the Shadowfell.
Yeah. Had an old man brain fart there.
Awesome. Yeah, that's clearer for me too, because I was always a little bit fuzzy on how the whole plane thing works. So basically like parallel universes and, you know, its own way.
Slightly different than our own world. They are like these, like, it is almost like other planets in the sense that it's vastly different with very little that is similar to its thing, but it's a different dimension, you know, so.
Right. So let's talk a little bit about, let's maybe go through elves in this episode like you would in their timeline of being a character. So obviously, you know, they're born. What age do they usually reach like not mental maturity, but.
Physical maturity.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If they live to be 800, 900 years old, like.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So they can live to be like 700 years old. But the easy math is just, you know, times 10 of a human. But they typically mature much slower. So around 100 years is when they kind of reach maturity. And what's interesting is that according to like the player's handbook, the way that they kind of think about that is that the individual chooses when they feel as though they are an adult. They're ready to go from childish things to adult things. And so it's, you know, kind of loosey-goosey. I'm sure someone who's very precocious could choose it at 70, although I feel like the families and the society wouldn't accept that. And there's some who will wait till they're 150 and you're like, dude, move out of your mom's basement, get a job.
Well, I was just thinking, like, how would that conversation with mom go? Mom's like, choose to grow up already. Like,
yeah,
it's like, what do they tell their kids?
Grow up. And they're like, okay, I will. And it's not like they choose to, and all of a sudden they go from kid to adult, like,
right?
Some kind of weird metamorphosis. they grow slowly over time and become adults. And then they kind of choose to enter into adult society. They pick a different name at that point that usually is similar to the child's version of the name. It's somewhat similar to going by Steve versus Steven, or, you know, Bill instead of William. But that's the idea. And then, you know, family members or people who were close friends in childhood might still call them that name from when they were growing up as a sign of not disrespect, but of familiarity and closeness of, you know, that longstanding relationship. I knew you back when kind of thing. So they mature around 100 years old, live to be about 700 years old. Of course, you can exceed that. And they are really just kind of like free spirits, no matter which kind of sub-race we will talk about later. But they know how to use their time well, and that is not to be stuck in the same drudgery over and over. They like to do different things. They don't like to typically keep the same schedule day to day like a human would. And they're not going to be obsessed with things like maybe dwarves might be. They are more about, it's kind of like a hippie kind of new agey, like just kind of follow your bliss kind of thing. But like they might spend 3 weeks making a single piece of art, whether that's a blade or a painting or a sculpture, and then, you know, take like a week just doing whatever, or go traveling, be an adventurer, see the world. and that kind of thing. And so they like variety, and they like to be able to do the things that that spark their interest. So they're not flighty, but at the same time, they hate the doldrums of repetition.
Right. And so they, generally speaking, they kind of always return back to, what would it be called? Their clan, their family.
More like houses, I think, is the idea.
Okay. So it's not really like a big community unit that all dwells in a certain place, that like the city you're born in, where you always, this is where you live the rest of your life, even though you might travel, you always come back. But that's the general concept, that they might go away, which, I mean, in elf years could be for, you know, a month or two, but in human years could be a century.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
And so they might go away and adventure and explore and experience. And so that's kind of what I was wondering next is, well, how do they heed the call of adventure? What sparks that? What encourages them to want to leave? And really, it could just be curiosity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it really is. It's a like with any, in any kind of fiction, characters that are especially long lived, the problem is always going to be boredom. And you see that with the elves. You see that they know that they have time, and so that there's no urgency in their lives in a kind of general sense. Like they can, you know, relentlessly pursue a goal, but it's not going to be the relentless pursuit of their whole lives. It'll be that pursuit of that moment. So they could, you know, enjoy, you know, centuries of exploration and finding out new things to perhaps get better at what they really love, which is, you know, crafting their magical art, or becoming a amazing musician, or being a skilled like forger of art objects or weapons, you know. So it's all, they kind of really have a holistic and kind of interdisciplinarian kind of vibe to them, you know, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Once, now that we have this idea of how they go adventuring, let's dive a little bit into their traits. So the racial traits that they get, or your, you know, the player will get by choosing specifically an elf. There's a number of them for elves.
And so I'll preface this with that. If, you know, you're new to D&D and you're like, oh, I've always wanted to be an elf, you know, be careful, because there's a lot here. So not only is it one of the races that have multiple, and it seems to be ever growing every year, sub-races, each base has a ton of stuff, and then you add even more things to with the sub-race. And so there's just a lot going on here. So oftentimes I'll wave people away from elves, not because I don't like them. I actually love elves, but there's just a lot happening mechanically. So at its base, dexterity increases by 2 because it gets into that kind of like just elegant grace they have all about them, whether they're painting or they're jumping from treetop to treetop or being archers or whatever it is. Dexterity is always going to be +2. Very, very helpful. And this is also, by the way, why a lot of people think that elves are a little OP, is because they have so many things, and then they get a +2 bonus to one of arguably the most OP stats, which is dexterity, which helps you with range and sneaking and acrobatics and avoiding fireballs, and your AC goes up. Like it just does so much stuff. So this being elves as well, with all their natural abilities, does even more things. So it can get a little wild. We talked about age already. Alignment is not super important. Remember, when it comes to alignment isn't prescriptive, it's descriptive. So that means that play your character as you intend, and that'll help you to understand what your alignment is. Don't pick an alignment and then have to be slavish to it and have to act a certain way because you chose a certain alignment.
We should actually do a mini episode at some point on alignment, because they're very fascinating, especially like the kind of like, I don't want to say rules you live by, but how you would act in certain alignments and stuff. So that would probably be a good topic for the future.
Let's jot that down and say our hilarious catchphrase, but we'll talk about that later.
We haven't said that in a while. It was about time.
You almost said it earlier and you like shied away from it. I was like, no, you had a chance.
It was about time.
So their size, they're medium, like most of the characters. Speed, 30 feet. And they also have dark vision, one of the best kind of like special abilities in the game, I think. So they can see 60 feet in dim light and darkness, but they see it in shades of gray as usual. They come with the perception skill. You just have proficiency with perception. And then because they have Fey ancestry, which we talked about before, they came from something that came from the Feywild, is that they have advantage on saving throws against being charmed, and magic cannot put them to sleep because elves don't sleep. Mm-hmm. Instead, they meditate, where they're kind of like, it's that like semi-conscious state where, like, you know, when you're like, you know your alarm is about to go off, but you can't sleep anymore, but you're not going to get up either. And you're kind of like just drifting in and out and kind of stuff. And sometimes, you know, you can have weird dreams that way. That's kind of what elves do instead, is so they're conscious. They make great like people to take watch because they can still get in their full rest, their long rest, but still be a pretty good lookout because they're not really asleep. They just kind of go inert in a way.
I don't think this is like quite side by side, but it reminds me a little bit of Doctor Strange. Particularly that scene in the newest movie with Benedict Cumberbatch, where he's sleeping in his bed, but then his like consciousness is like up reading books and learning all night.
His astral form. Yeah. It's kind of like that, less magical, but yeah, basically. So the idea here, I think too, is that their brains are just wired differently, or actually probably more efficient. And so they don't need total unconsciousness for the brain to kind of defrag and send memories to long-term memory, that kind of stuff, is what we think maybe happens when we sleep. No one's really sure, which is
our puny human understanding of the brain at this point. Yeah.
Yeah. It's unsettling to realize that with all of our knowledge, we don't know exactly how, like why we sleep and why it's necessary, but it is. So, so when they meditate, they dream kind of, and they only have to do it for 4 hours a day for them to be rejuvenated. After 4 hours, they can get a whole long rest instead of doing 8 hours, which is fun because if you considered a party of all like Warforged who also don't sleep, or elves, that would be an amazing team because they're just basically like, you know, burning the candle on both ends, that kind of thing. To kind of metagame it, but yeah. And then the languages are read, write, and speak, common and elvish. And elvish is a really common language in a lot of games where, you know, magical scrolls or really ancient lore is probably either going to be in draconic or in elvish. Those are always great languages to pick. And anything that's more than, you know, a few hundred years old or even a few thousand years old, then you get into celestial, abyssal, primordial, a lot of like crazy languages from the before civilized times. But elvish, great language to pick. So that's kind of elf at its base, but you're not done because then you also pick a sub race, which adds even more things to the character.
So you get all of that stuff as well as, or instead of, I always forget,
as well as
whatever bonuses or traits you get from your sub race.
Right. It's additive.
So
not replacement.
Yeah. There's two or there's three?
There's three, but actually there's four.
Well, thank you for clearing that up. Would you like to elaborate?
No, I'll talk about that later.
Just leave it there.
So in the player's handbook, there's three. There is a secret fourth option in, I believe it's the Monster's Manual, but they brought it to the forefront, I want to say in Mordekainen's. Which is the Eladrin, which is like the Eladrin is a kind of elf, but not really, because they grew up and were born in the Feywild and then came to the Prime Material Plane. Whereas elves have been living and growing up here in the Prime Material for, you know, millennia, but their origins are in the Feywild, so they're even more magical elves than elves. Right. So they're elves plus. So there's a option, I believe, in the Monster Manual of how you could play a Eladrin. And then they kind of like did a full workup. I think it was in Mordekainen's. But let's talk about the ones in the Player's Handbook first, I think. So what's the first one there? I don't have it.
First one there is High Elf.
High Elves. Yes. So there's basically We talked about the magical nature element of elves, and the high elves, they skew more towards the magical side of things. So the high elves are basically going to be have a natural predisposition to magic, learned magic. So things like being a wizard, possibly a sorcerer, especially if they have the wild magic feature, the kind of the Feywild sorcery origin. But with them, they're going to get an additional intelligence increase by one. They also know how to use the long sword, short bow, and long bow. They learned one cantrip of your choice from the wizard spell list and use intelligence for it. And then you can just pick another language to know how to speak, read, and write.
That's convenient.
So, it is. So again, making the case of why elves are OP. And so these guys are typically seen as having a bit more refined culture. They have chosen to become elevated in the societies of the world because of their long lives and their magical art. And so they might live in far off, finely crafted, you know, beautiful walled cities on an island somewhere with tall ivory tower, like literally ivory towers, where magic is commonplace. It's just as easy as, you know, it's kind of like when you grow up rich and you're just used to having a maid and a butler. Like, they just grow up magical and are used to using prestidigitation to clean their clothes. No big deal. they typically come from like kingdoms of societies, as opposed to some of the others, which are more kind of naturey based. So that's kind of the idea with the high elves.
It says in there too that there's actually a lot of information there, but it's talking about how there's different types, and one of them is like super I'm better than all kind of attitude. Yes. And I mean, do you get that a lot with high elves in general, because they are so scholarly and learned, and, you know, like it logically, like when you do actually know more than almost everybody, you're gonna have that air of, well, yes, I do know more than you. Like, yeah.
Not only have I been alive longer than your entire bloodline, I have to sleep half as much as you do. So yeah, I know more than you. If you've ever seen the haughty elf trope, this is where that's kind of coming from. And so elves are typically described as not being, we're better than you, stand aside, but rather we know that we have all these advantages, and if you make a mistake or you're rash or quick, prone to violence or being easily insulted, they'll kind of like be gracious about it. Like, well, they don't know any better, which I don't know if that's better when they treat the rest of
very placating.
They treat the rest of the races as kids, right? They're like, you know, you're the children. You're like, I'm 70. You're like, I remember 70. That was so long ago. I wasn't even an adult yet. And you're like, dang it. So there can be that element of that, but it doesn't mean that they're always prideful, but there certainly is a propensity and a risk for developing those kind of characteristics. And I'm kind of two minds, like, would they be more prone to be that way if they had been around other races, or if they haven't been around other races? You know what I mean? So if you grow up for 250 years in exclusively an elven kingdom, and then you go out adventuring, would you be like more forgiving of the shortcomings of others? Cause you're like, oh, okay, they didn't have what I have. Or are that you're gonna be like, what is wrong with you people? Like, because it's way different than everything you've ever known.
Yeah, I feel like it would just, like, I feel like how it would be portrayed would be this, or would be the same. Like, the end result would be the same, but the way it would come out would be different. So it's that idea for us, like when we see an escalator at the mall, like it's mm-hmm. just, you just get on it and you go up. But other people who have never seen that type of technology, like, can get, we've all seen those videos online of people that have never been witness to this type of technology that get really overwhelmed by it. And so I feel like if that was the case and you were reclusive, that you would end up kind of offending, but not on purpose, because like, this is just normal. What don't you get? Versus right. If you do know these things, that you might be more like, oh my gosh, and I don't have time to explain this to somebody else again.
Yeah, exactly.
So I feel like you'd get the end result would be the same, but
yeah, and that's a great consideration for someone who wants to role play an elf. Like, you know, do you treat everyone else like they're from Wyoming, where there's only two elevators in the whole state, or escalators in the whole state? But you know, either way. but yeah, so that's the high elves, and in some older editions and other settings too, there's a fun name for them. They're called gold elves or sun elves. And they were kind of like split up, like there were some like sun elves and moon elves, or like gold and silver elves. And even the gold elves was sometimes called the silver elves, dross elves, instead of silver elves, because dross is like the kind of like silvery byproduct when you refine something, which is like a super sophisticated dig. Yeah, so in like, I think Dragonlance has that and some other things too, but yeah.
I love that all of their extra traits are all focused around things that would naturally happen just by devoting yourself to learning. So obviously your intelligence is going to go up, like weapon training. Yes, you can easily do that with just, I mean, even just reading enough books, or for us watching enough YouTube channels, you could probably glean something from it. Learning a cantrip for, you know, magic, again, that like, is that innate magical that just exists in your world, like you were saying? And then the extra language, once again, just spend enough time and you can easily learn another language. So I like how those are all kind of wrapped up well into.
Yeah, it's very well done thematically, for sure.
Yeah. All right. Next up is Wood Elf.
Yeah. So let's see here. Wood Elf. Wood Elves like their High Elf cousins or offshoots, they lean one direction as well. They lean more towards the nature element of who they are and what their race is. And so they are going to be the ones more like in The Hobbit, right? Where there's the Forest Kingdom versus Rivendell, which was more of like a society and kingdom. So these ones are going to live in, you know, deep in the woods where things are really wild and untamed. They're going to be the ones who are very much in tune with nature. Druids, rangers are really great choices for this. And mechanically speaking, they have ability score increase of one for wisdom. And then they also have a faster walking speed, 35 feet. They can attempt to hide even when they're only lightly obscured by foliage, heavy rains, falling snow, mist.
They're like PETA.
Other things like that. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, they're just like vroom, just suddenly gone. So in natural environments, even if they're slightly obscured, they can just disappear, like blend into the environment. And then they also can choose another skill or tool proficiency. That's kind of neat as well. So, yeah. So they kind of, it's like how they had the perception, bonus for the high elves. They can just kind of choose something else. And they're not really prescriptive about that.
Okay. Yeah. In the player's handbook, it says weapon training.
Does it?
Yeah. Weapon so training? I don't know if that's like a change from an older module or something, but yeah, elf weapon training, you have proficiency with the long sword, short sword, short bow, and long bow. Wow, so all of them.
Oh, so they get that too, just like the high elves. Okay, because I'm like looking at, reminding myself from D&D Beyond. So maybe that's why it's a little bit different. Let me double check myself before I wreck myself. Where is it? So yeah, high elves, wood elves. So they also have the proficiency with the long sword, short bow, and long bow. Okay, yeah, there we go.
So would you say that wood elves are naturally a little more reclusive too? If it's like live deep in the, you know, deep forest, there's not going to be a lot of people out there normally. They might come across adventurers or other random stuff, or when they adventure out of where they live, but generally speaking, they're going to grow up somewhere that's not hustling and bustling with lots of other types of cultures and races. And
right. And so far, both the ones we've described have been very kind of isolated, because they recognize that a lot of the other races, they change so quickly that it seems like for them, they see things on the long game. And so they're establishing things at their own pace for their own liking. That's very much in tune with the world, whether that's in tune with the world's magic or in tune with the world's natural phenomenon. And so it would make sense that they are, so they're not reclusive in that sense. It's just because they go at their own pace, they end up being places where other people aren't.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So they're not just looking for like the easiest place to start a new settlement because it's close to the coast, or there's a river, or there's a deposit of, you know, gold ore here in these mountains. They're choosing it based on different things. And so they're going to be just other places. But elves, they're not reclusive in the sense that we never leave our own. And so you'll never see them in the city. They're actually probably one of the most common, along with dwarves, humans, half-elves, and the like, to see in a big city like Waterdeep, where there's going to be a lot of different kinds of races all living together. Mm-hmm. So reclusive isn't the right word necessarily. It's more the idea of they have their own ideas about what makes a good place to live. How about that?
So with that topic of reclusivity, let's move on to our third type in here, which is the drow.
The drow. Yes. And it is pronounced drow. I've heard other people pronounce it other ways. I grew up saying drow, and there's a great pronunciation guide on D&D Beyond, and it is drow, not drow. Or the dark elves. So this is interesting. So when I got into fifth edition, I was surprised to find them just hanging out here as just an option anybody can take in the player's handbook, because
they used to just be an enemy, right?
They used to be just monsters, listing in the monster manual. And they were always evil because of their worship style and who they worshiped. And it kind of just like an option that was taken away from them. And I know through the editions that there'd be like supplements that come out, like Volos or Mordekainen's, right, or Xanathar's would, where they would open up that option to people. But they chose to have the drow here just plain and center part of the core rules. And I think a lot of it is because of just love for a character in the D&D novels called Dritz Duerden, who was from Neverwinter. And is a ranger, has a panther as a pet, that's actually a figurine of Wondrous Power, has, you know, scimitars of speed, and he's awesome, and he never loses, and yada yada. And so he was like used to be the only one exception of like, no, he's awesome. And they kind of like soften that, and you see that happening more and more with Tasha's too, where they're like, well, mm-hmm, they're not all evil. It's just that if they grew up in this society, this is the predisposition. And that makes sense, especially if your whole culture worships Loth, which is an evil, evil spider queen goddess, that has zero value to any kind of mortal life. I could see why they would brand you evil, because that's by any measure evil. So the drow are interesting because so they didn't do away with like that stigma.
Mm-hmm.
They just let you play them, which is an interesting choice. And so you kind of have to figure out with your own backstory and with your DM, how are drow viewed by the rest of society? Are they just uncommon and mistrusted because they're not very, they're not usually out and about and mixing with the populace, or are they outright hated and you're going to come across just bigotry all the time? And so you have to kind of figure that out. But usually they have very, very dark skin, looks like kind of like obsidian, and then really like white hair is the kind of the idea. And then some really kind of cool like eye colors. It says here in the book, lilac, silver, pink, red, and blue, which is awesome, but they're very pale eyes.
Well, it makes sense because their whole thing is that they, you know, were raised and lived underground,
right?
They never really saw the light of day. And so you're, you know, even with like modern day creatures and other things that we're finding in the depths of the ocean and whatnot, there's some major changes for survival mechanisms to survive in that part of the world, which is probably how those traits kind of conceptually developed.
Yeah, exactly. So mechanically speaking, drow characters, they're going to also add a +1 to their charisma. They have, but I love this term, superior dark vision. So they can actually have dark vision out to 120 feet, which is kind of fun, because like you said, they're used to being underground. And then they do have a drawback. And some of these characters like this do have this, like the Duergar and the Smurfeblin. Smurfeblin?
What is that? That's the coolest word I've ever heard.
They're deep gnomes.
Okay.
They're underdark gnomes, just like how the Duergar are like underdark dwarves. And
I feel like I should say bless you.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate that. It's been cold here. But the Smurfablin, just on a quick tangent, they're purposely the name. I can't believe I'm going to say this. You look at the name and you're like, wait, did you just sneak the word Smurf into their name? Because they're Smurfs, okay? They're from the same mythological like source text as Smurfs, the cartoon. Because they're the Smurfablin. You're like, wait, did you just say Smurf? So we'll talk about them later.
We'll talk about that later. Oh, we're packing them all in this episode.
Yeah, let's do it all. So they have sunlight sensitivity. So basically, if they are in direct sunlight, so they're in the shade or it's early morning, late afternoon, they're okay. But they have disadvantage on attack rolls and on perception checks that rely on sight. If they're in the bright sun, because their eyes just aren't used to that bright, bright light. And so it's just a byproduct of the environment where they were born. They weren't built to be in the bright sunshine. And so, but there's a lot of ways you can get around that. I know one character on Acquisitions Incorporated, the C team, Cathriss, he wore just a big floppy sun hat. Like he was a middle-aged woman in the garden. And that's how he did it. And it was awesome because he's like a super spooky warlock with a floppy sun hat. But to offset this, what they get that's really, really cool is they get drow magic. So they're even more magical than the high elves. They start off knowing the dancing lights cantrip. When they get to third level, they can cast fairy fire once a day. And at fifth level, they can cast the darkness spell once per day. And they use charisma, of course, for that as well. And then drow weapon training, proficiency with rapiers, short swords, and hand crossbows. So the same kind of weapon training we saw before, but with some slight variations to them as well.
Cool. And I've heard some lore. I really don't know much about this, and I could be way off base, but I've heard within like drow culture that the females are the boss.
Yep. It's matriarchal.
Right.
Yes. And that oftentimes is used as a narrative hook as to why there's an adventurer in your party who is drow, because oftentimes they'll be male, because there's like, you know what? Loth is a jerk. And I've reached the maximum of what I can achieve in my own society because, well, I can't go any farther. So I'm going to go out on my own and do my own thing. But it is not to say that you can't have female characters at all. But that's kind of the vibe that was going on with Jarrett Stewarden as well, as he kind of left that whole culture for a lot of those same reasons.
Mm-hmm. Right. And like
even Jarlaxle from Waterdeep, who's a head of a crime family. Same kind of thing. A lot of his retinue, his kind of cohorts are a lot of like disgraced and disgruntled male drow fighters and rogues and things that left for some of those same reasons. So it's pretty common in that sense.
Right. I learned about that mechanic, I guess you could call it, the hard way, in that I think it was, yeah, Lost Mines when I was playing it again, my first campaign. There's a changeling in there who shapeshifts into a drow. And I had this like interaction going on and the party was like, oh, well, clearly something's wrong here because like the male drow would never talk to the female drow that way. And I was just like, uh-oh, what did I do? Mm-hmm. And like, I kind of like sent them off on this weird tangent unintentionally because I had no clue that that was a mechanic. And so the way that I was like playing this scene, they were drawing stuff from it and they're like, oh, well, this is not how they would act in this culture. So something funky is going on. And I was like, no, it's not really. But what did I do?
Yeah. Well, you just roll with it and go, mm-hmm. Yeah. Good eye, guys. Good eye. Yeah. And then weave something out of it. That's funny.
Yeah.
That's
really or later funny. They could be like, what was up with that? Hey, I guess you'll never know.
Yeah. Just driving crazy. I love it. Yeah. I love it. So those are the main three sub races for elves. But as I mentioned before, there are also the Eladrin. And so Eladrin is considered a sub-race of elf. And so I believe, I'm double-checking right now, that it's another additive thing. So if you choose Eladrin as your sub-race, you also would, if you choose elf as your race and you chose Eladrin as your sub-race, then you would add these things to the base elf kind of benefits. And what's really cool is that when they spec'd out the Eladrin full on and not just kind of an alternate option in the monster manual, they actually made like four versions or four flavors, how about that, of Eladrin. And each of your Eladrin can be either an autumn, a winter, a spring, or a summer. And it's more than just like what kind of makeup they can wear and what kind of clothes color looks good on them. It's actually, I know things, and it's actually more about the temperament and how their magic, because they're super magically infused, having come from this magical realm, it flavors how that magic works and even gives you some suggestions of different personality traits and flaws that might go with that. But at their base, Eladrin, they get a +1 to their charisma score, and they also gain a feature that's a really cool feature called Fae Step. So basically, once per short or long rest, they can basically Fae Step. They can just teleport 30 feet to an unoccupied area. They can just kind of bamf. I guess it's kind of like them tapping into like, you know, like pseudo going into the Feywild just for a second to bypass the intervening space.
It's like skipping a rock across the surface of water.
Exactly. Oh, that's really good. That's really good, actually. Yeah, so they kind of like skip teleport 30 feet. They only get to do it once per short rest or long rest. But when they get to third level, based on if they were in autumn, winter, whatever, they get extra benefits whenever they Fae Step. So that's kind of neat too. Or you could play the one that's in the DMG. Okay, sorry, the Eladrin's in the DMG a option, not the monster manual. I'm thinking of the half dragon, where it's something a little more simple, +1 to intelligence instead of +1 to charisma. You have the elf weapon training, long sword, short sword, long bow, short bow, and then you can Misty Step once per short or long rest. So it's kind of the same idea, but they just expanded on it a little bit. So that's kind of fun too.
Right. The seasons things remind me a little bit of the Genasi, how there's yes. You know, the four types. It's that's kind of like it resonates with me on that same playing field of just it taps into a certain aspect of this thing. So in this case, the seasons that, you know, helps to manifest parts of what you can do or just organically are capable of.
Yeah, exactly. And if I remember correctly, like the Feywild is described, like you can go to different parts of it. That's always winter or always autumn or always summer, you know, kind of idea. And like these kind of really wild biomes. And so I think this is kind of a head nod to that. So Eladrin are fun. I don't often see them chosen to be played, but they're really, really cool. And Will Wheaton, when he was playing D&D on the Acquisitions Incorporated podcast, he played Eofel, who was an Eladrin.
Okay. So I know elves are like one of your favorite races. So yes. what just fun combo or build up would you recommend to people with just having thought a lot about elves and how they intertwine well into classes or some of these other things that you can maybe throw out for people to consider playing around with?
Well, I mean, if you want to go with like to like, where what's going to accentuate certain classes where the different skills or ability score increases with the high elves, anything that needs intelligence. So obviously wizard would be really great, and their dexterity to the AC isn't bad either. With your wood elves, rangers, druids would be really great because of the wisdom increase, maybe even a paladin of one of the elven gods. You can find a list of those in the DMG as well. And then for the drow, you could do, because of the charisma, warlock is really great. Sorcerer is really great. You could even be a paladin, which is really great. Also in fiction, rangers and thieves are also very popular choices because of the narrative aspect of kind of being pariahs to society. So a thief is like, well, you don't like me anyway, fine. I'm going to live in the shadowy underbelly of your society and rob from you.
Yeah, or and by being, thief, you're kind of talking about D&D like rogue, right?
Rogue, yeah, exactly. Sorry. Okay. I got reset to second edition all of a sudden.
Someone push your reset button.
Yeah, seriously. No. Someone whack me in the head.
Try taking your batteries out and putting them back in again.
Wait, no. the or like rangers where they're going to be in the kind of the wild places away from civilized society because of who they are and how they're perceived are really great. And then for Eladrin, because they're going to get depending on which kind of Eladrin you pick, it could really be anything because you're doing intelligence or charisma. So it seems like they're leaning towards magic users. But if you want to pick something that is opposite and kind of one of these things is doing its own thing kind of element, I would think like a barbarian Eladrin would be really cool and make them like a summer, a winter or like an autumn or something. And because it'd be really interesting to watch that that kind of wild passion of a creature from the Feywild along with barbarian rage. And when they get to third level, the Eladrin's Misty Step kind of does some extra kind of cool things like extra damage or some area effects. And then also a lot of barbarians, if they choose like the Totem Warrior, they get a lot of cool like area effects every time they rage. And so there's some really interesting stackable things there that would be really interesting to watch. And the dexterity, the plus two to dexterity wouldn't hurt with the unarmored defense that the barbarian is going to rely on. So it'd be a fun way to see this magical thing that would, you would seem to be, you know, refined, but yet it's not about anger and rage. It's about passion and being kind of given into that wildness of your home in the Feywild. I think that'd be fun.
Thank you guys so much for equipping the compendium today. If you're interested in diving into a different type of character development, consider checking out my brand new life coaching experience, the Identity D&D Workshop. I handcrafted this experience using the framework of building a D&D character with some of the tools that I know as a life coach to help people do an investigation check on themselves and who they really want to show up as in life. As a special thank you, Compendium listeners can get $25 off this 5-hour workshop by using the code COMPENDIUM, that's COMPENDM, at registration. Just visit www.envisagelifecoach.com and click on workshops to learn more or register. We hope you guys enjoyed listening in this week to our deep dive into the elven race of D&D. Another episode will be published in 2 weeks, so make sure you subscribe to the podcast to be the first to know when it's available. You can also follow us online by searching for The Compendium on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Thanks again for joining us, and we'll see you next time.